it cuts a lot of people off of their own growth because they don't dare to be themselves. They feel like they've got to be something that fits into what their mother or father think they should be.
Like on the movie?
Yeah. Yeah, right. Some put like, I never stand for my father, the problem there. And Blake felt that this whole female principle was such an enveloping one. Now you know yourself, you know, when you think of motherhood, you know, there's nothing bigger in America than motherhood. You know that. And you know, and her arms just come out, and I've got six kids, so I know. You know, and I just love to just put my arms around them. But you know, they're not your kids. And when you have children of your own, you've got to realize this. They're not yours. And the great thing that Care Blake was in the 18th century decrying and shouting about the fact that possession of children, the possessiveness that parents had of their children was wrong. That those children did not belong to them as property, and that they weren't something that they should be, that they should be clutched and cosseted and finally, you know, do what we tell you to do and go to the schools we say and become the kind of person we want. Now you kids are growing up in a really liberated generation, because you've had a lot of kids just before you really suffered so that you could come into this kind of a life in which there's a lot more openness. The kids that really went through it about 15, 20 years ago and had a lot of back talk, and they did a lot of dumb, stupid things, and they were a lot deeper in drugs. Just really, really bad. They had a tough time. But they were trying to, you know, come out from all this mother principle thing, this motherhood business that was just suffocating them. I mean, it's why people get the idea that mothering and smothering can be the same thing. Now, I hope you don't misunderstand me, that I am saying that mothers shouldn't be mothers and fathers shouldn't be fathers. But what I am saying is that the problem of relationship, whether it's with family or with country or with tradition or whatever, you've got to discover a relationship of your own. I mean, in other words, you can't live in your parents' God or their relationship with God. It's got to be yours. You can't live in their relationship, their kinds of decisions. You've got to make your own decisions if you're going to be, you know, an adult person. And as Blake understood it, if you're going to be a regenerated person, you are responsible. In a real sense, he understood existentialism and the responsible life of the individual much more than you'd ever dream being in that particular period and being a visionary of the kind he was. So it's
So what do we do with people like Bill Gothard? Basic youth.
Who's he?
Institute on Basic Youth Conflicts. He
the guy with Basic Youth Conflicts?
Yeah. Yeah.
I looked over that.
Yeah, Carol looked at it. He said there was some stuff that was good in it. You know, he didn't oppose everything.
He said stuff like, you're a Christian, since you're a Christian, you're to do what your parents say, because God will accomplish his will through your parents, no matter if they're Christian or not. And so this one girl wanted to go to a missionary school and then go on to be a missionary, mm-hmm. but her parents were so against it because they're anti-Christ, and so then they told her no, because mm-hmm. Bill Cothard told her she was supposed to be doing mm-hmm. that way. She refused to go. Mm-hmm. She didn't refuse. She said, okay, I won't go, mm-hmm. and she missed the whole calling.
What did he say then?
He said that was good. That's the way to do it, because yeah. God must have had something yeah. else in mind.
Yeah. Well, you know, you see, that kind of thing is what Blake is very much opposed to, because he feels that you're putting authority, a kind of a, a power in authority as such, whether there's any reason for it or not. I mean, you know, from the point of view of really understanding it. And when you read the Gospels, I don't know about Bill Gothard, but I think he ought to read the Gospels a little more carefully, because although I don't go along with all that Blake is saying by any means, as I said, you can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. But on the other hand, Jesus was very, very adamant on the fact that you follow me and don't you pay any attention to what the rest of them are saying. And unless we believe that there is a relationship here that's valid, what are we in it for? I mean, are we in it because we're just living by a bunch of rules? You know, that's where I would have trouble. I have had a lot of instinctive resentment to basic youth conflicts. I didn't know his name. I'm glad of that, because then I don't feel that about him, but I'll try to forgive him. But as Carol said, there are a lot of things about authority that are important, and tradition is not to be thrown out totally. It's not that you just dump everything, which is what happened when all these hippies came along and had to, you know, they just tried to get out of this mess that everything seemed to be in and try to stand on their own feet and kind of breathe a fresher air, and then they did throw everything out. So then the natural thing is that you take this opposite approach and say, you know, we've got to get back to authority. That's a trouble. Nobody pays any attention to their parents anymore. And I think that there is a lot of that. Bruno Bettelheim, for example, used to stew and stew about the fact that children need authority. And I believe that firmly, that kids have to be spanked. I don't believe in permissiveness. But what I'm saying is that individually, if you cannot stand up as an adult and say, I am a person before God, and whether I'm the daughter of John or Mary or Harold or whoever, makes no difference in terms of my relationship with God. I'm responsible to him. And my relationship to Jesus Christ is in that light. And I mean, how in the dickens are you going to run back to Papa and Mama every time you're going to make a decision? You know, you can't do that either. I think what he probably is getting at is the fact that young people, now that I have this business with a mission thing, that would really turn me off. Wow, really upset me. But then you see, Bill Gothard is also becoming an authority. See, he is another authority above the basic youth conflicts. He's the one that determines for a lot of people what the conflicts are and that you've got to obey your parents. So then after you get through Bill Gothard, then you go to God and say, now we've gone to parents and Bill Gothard says this, and now we go to God and find out from him. Now I think that's a lot of, there's a lot of basically good psychology in the fact that many, many people are really in need of some kind of authority, and I think we all need a respect for tradition. We need a respect for certain criteria that have been fought through and experienced and won over a long period of time. And when I said you have to say no to your parents, that doesn't mean that you say, you know, thumb your nose at them, or that you don't respect them or love them. But it simply means that issues will come and you're going to have to say, I am now my own, I am responsible for myself. I can't live on what my parents are telling me anymore. I mean, I've got to make up my own mind. Maybe I agree exactly with them, but it's got to be mine, not theirs. You see? And it's I can't tell you how important it is that you know that it's your own. It's not something that you're just, you know, pre-digested. But of course, Blake was much more violent on us than that. He just felt like, the problem with the whole, this whole soft approach of, you know, coddling people and keeping them from being vigorous people was what was going to finally produce a complete collapse in civilization. And it's true. I mean, look at Nazi Germany and Victorian England, and not too far from us either. You know, a lot of our sort of namby-pambiness comes in the fact that we don't stand up. We want to be a majority. We want to be along with the group instead of being willing to stand on our own feet and do our own thing.
Carol said this morning that the United States now is more inclined to authority to go along than Nazi Germany was.
Well, you see, this problem, you run into a real reaction of needing, almost a dictator. And what we were afraid of is that we were going to get one. But fortunately, it's really, I don't say fortunately Watergate, because I don't think anything that is a crime is really fortunate. But I do think that it was a good thing that when something happened, it happened in a public way so that we really sensed the need for reassessing what we've got. Now, you see, what Blake is getting at is that no democracy can survive unless people are individuals. Now, you can't have a democracy if people don't stand on their own feet and can talk, you know, can vote, can say what they think. If they don't, I mean, if they're going to be the way most people are, generally, because it's so much easier to follow the stream than it is to fight against it, you get a dictatorship, because it works better. All totalitarian states work better. They go so much faster, because they don't have to bother to ask a lot of people what to do. They have to have a committee on it. The guy that's in charge says, we'll do it. I had quite an argument with Keith Smith on that last night because of what I said about Skinner. Because he felt that Skinner was, you know, kind of right. I cannot see that.
What Skinner do you talk about?
B.F. Skinner, Beyond Freedom and Dignity. And he's a big behavioral psychologist. He wrote Walden 2. Anyway, this whole thing with mother, this motherhood business, is, as I say, this is not against individual mothers. It's not that you're opposed to having families, or that you're opposed to having mother love or father love or children loving parents or any of that sort of thing. It's just that when that becomes an idol, when that becomes the big support in your life, you're not going to live your own life, you see. And he brings it out. He's very clear. Now, you know, when you saw that, as I said, a funny looking face, he was not very good at faces. He didn't look like paper dolls. Funny person, that little face up there. But you got such a feeling of expansion from that figure with his arms out and the rainbow. And the huge rainbow and the sparkles coming out. Now that person is neither man nor woman, although he talks about the masculine principle as being the big principle in all of creation. But I mean, our girls are not supposed to feel defensive about that either, because, I mean, women have masculine tendencies just like men have feminine tendencies. I mean, nobody is straight one or the other. So, I mean, you know, forget it. Try to loosen up and don't feel like whenever anybody talks about feminine or masculine, you right away have to put your hackles up and, you know, watch out because they're attacking our liberation. I mean, not that at all. What Blake was getting at, and he had a good biblical foundation here, he said the problem had been that actually the understanding of creation was originally with this, with a masculine principle that included the feminine. And I had a little argument with Mrs. Crook on that last night, because I said, you know, well, we were. That was true, because we were both created at the same time. We were there. I said, after all, if I came out of Adam, I must have been feminine when I came out. I mean, there must have been feminine in Adam. I mean, how could there be a rib that wasn't feminine, if that's the way you're going to put it, you know? And, she didn't think that was right, but I still think it's right. But anyway, he also, in the Genesis story, he created them. It's in the plural when he creates man. So it's not as if there were just one single sex image in that first creation. But what Blake was concerned for here is the fact that when you begin to put this feminine thing in with such a force, now just ask yourself, what is it that people think about when they think about Christmas? What do they see? See the baby Jesus, and who else? The Madonna. They see the Madonna and the baby. Now, for most people, that's Christianity. That's all they ever think of. They don't. They never get to Easter. So they don't know about the cross, except, you know, in terms of maybe it's something on somebody's wall or somebody wears it in their ears or something. But I mean, the real thing is the Madonna and the baby, and the bigger figure is the Madonna. And Blake said, this figure of the woman, of the feminine principle coming in, really dominates the picture of early Christianity, all through early Roman Catholic Christianity.
I thought it was really interesting about his painting, because whenever you do a bit, they were doing the poem of the lamb, the child had a man's head that didn't have a baby's
yes,
head.
Quite
had
often.
A man's head.
Yeah. Part of that is that he wanted to emphasize the fact that everybody has the possibility of being full grown. You've got the possibility of being a full grown imagination, a full grown person. But his concern about this Madonna thing was interesting to me, because that is a carryover also from a lot of the early Greek religions. They had a lot of so much stuff with their female gods, goddesses. They were just, the goddesses were really heavy for a lot of the early religions. And the church, although it didn't adopt a pagan thing, it picked up certain things that got priority. And what did Jesus say about his mother?
Who is my mother?
Yeah. Who is my mother? And who are my brothers? They that do the will of God. He took care of his mother at the cross. But there's nothing in the Gospels, there's nothing in all of the epistles that give you any indication that the Virgin Mary should have been as important as she was as far as the development of the church is concerned. The one great thing about the Virgin Mary is the Magnificat, which is simply tremendous. And in that, she absolutely, if you read it, it's in Luke, you'll find that there's nothing to expand her ego. Nothing at all. It's all what God had done. And when Jesus got into the saddle and started moving, there was nothing, there was no business with paying attention. Even when, you remember at the wedding at Cana, you know, he wasn't going to pay attention to her there either. She couldn't even get his attention at first. And then he said, well, okay, I'll fix the lineup. But, you know, this is interesting, because I think you need to realize that it's not a matter of of men and women, you know, having, you know, clashes, but that it's just that there is a kind of a tendency lots of times in the role that women have played to keep things more conservative, kind of poor. Well, I'm always doing this. I'm always trying to fix up after Carol's, you know, and I said, oh, he didn't really mean that. Well, of course he meant it. And I should have my hand slapped for saying he didn't mean it. But, you know, I thought, well, it's much better if I tell him that, you know, it's not been quite that bad. But, I mean, that is an innate thing about the way in which we as women have had to live, because we've always had to kind of keep things, kind of keep them going, and it's all right, because after all, we were in charge of the nest, and somebody had to protect that. But when that tendency becomes powerful, you know what happens then? Anything radical gets, you know, in some way or other. And Blake's big fight was the radical and the conservative imagination fighting and fighting and fighting for place. And I'm just going to read before the ending here. I just like to read the end of this one poem, because I think I don't know if you, I think you've got a little more understanding of what Blake was talking about, and I sure preached a lot to people. I hope it isn't in too much. This is this poem that Carol read a couple nights ago, I think, and that they use at the end of the film. There's a great piece of music that goes with it. I'll not sing it, but
The music in that Stefan Williams wrote that to go with Blake's Fortune.
Yes, he did. But the one that goes with this one was written by an Englishman, and they use it as kind of an English national, sort of a national anthem. And it's really a marvelous piece of music. And but Blake understood, he wanted England, he certainly loved England and wanted it to be changed, but he also saw in understanding Jerusalem and understanding Albion and all these figures, he was thinking of the whole world and its regeneration and its renewal. And he says here that if we believe Christ and his apostles, that there is a class of men whose whole delight is in destroying, we don't want either Greek or Roman models. If we are but just and true to our own imaginations, those worlds of eternity in which we shall live forever in Jesus our Lord. That's the way he ends the preface to Milton, and these are the lines. And did those feet in ancient time walk upon England's mountains green, and was the holy Lamb of God on England's pleasant pastures seen? And did the countenance divine shine forth upon our clouded hills? And was Jerusalem builded here among these dark satanic mills? Bring me my bow of burning gold, bring me my arrows of desire, bring me my spear, O clouds unfold, bring me my chariot of fire. I will not cease from mental fight, nor shall my sword sleep in my hand, till we have built Jerusalem in England's green and pleasant land. Would to God that all the Lord's people were prophets. It's got at the end from Numbers. Well, thank you for being so good and read one thing from Blake that that I intended to read yesterday, and I didn't get to it because I spent a lot of time on that female principle. But there are two short poem. There's two short long poems, but I mean they're longer poems they wrote. They're a series of sort of aphorisms or couplets of that he wrote with the idea of kind of clearing in his mind, in a way, what he thought about life and the imagination and so on. And I'm going to read some of these because they're some of the most quoted in the English language. They're the one. This is the this particular one is the one that well, if the sun and moon should doubt comes from this one. And to see a world in a grain of sand and so on comes also out of the same collection. It happens that this particular poem or collection of couplets, you should really call it, was so mixed up when it was found that nobody really knew what kind of order they were in. So a number of different people collected and tried to put them together. Finally, they were put in this particular order. William Butler Yeats was one of the men who did a lot with Blake, and he and Mr. Ellis, who edited this particular edition, put them together in a fairly good order. And I'm just going to read. I'm not going to read every one, but I'll read some of them, and you'll see the they're rather like. How many of you have ever read any of the things from the Icelandic or Norse, the runes, the little funny little couplets that used to come out of the old Norse and Icelandic mythology and literature? They're little couplets or four lines together that have what we call kind of a gnomic meaning. They have a double entendre. They're sort of a two meanings. What's there when you read it is one thing, and then there's also another meaning underneath, and it's kind of like a riddle. You have to think about, now what does it really mean? Some of Blake's things are written rather like this, and when I read these, you can see what I mean. To see a world in a grain of sand and a heaven in a wildflower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour. A robin red breast in a cage puts all heaven in a rage. A dove house filled with doves and pigeons shudders hell through all its regions. A dog starved at his master's gate predicts the ruin of the state. A horse misused upon the road calls to heaven for human blood. A skylark wounded on the wing doth make a cherub cease to sing. Every wolf's and lion's howl raises from hell a human soul. You can see if you can make sense out of these. The lamb misused breeds public strife and yet forgives the butcher's knife. The bat that flits at close of eve has left the brain that won't believe. The owl that calls upon the night speaks the unbeliever's fright. Now, think about these also, not necessarily as stating some very clear truth, but hinting at some profound truth. Now, and also think about how does it describe a sense of how you feel. The owl that calls upon the night speaks the unbeliever's fright. How many of you have heard the owls up here? Mm-hmm. If you walk up mm-hmm. around here now, around the Chalet Circle up here, about twilight, it really is a woo. There's two or three owls that live out here. Why they don't hoot in the summer, I don't know. But they really do make a very well, I would say it's not exactly it's not the kind of sound that you like to think of when you're all by yourself. I know I always hate to come up here all alone at night when the owls are hooting. And it's not that I'm afraid of anything, and I'm not afraid of anything coming out of the woods, and I'm not afraid of the owls. Now, why is it that one sound like that can call up so much in your mind that you can have a feeling of shiver about it? Well, I would say it's not exactly it's not the kind of sound that you like to think of when you're all by yourself. I know I always hate to come up here all alone at night when the owls are hooting. And it's not that I'm afraid of anything, and I'm not afraid of anything coming out of the woods, and I'm not afraid of the owls. Now, why is it that one sound like that can call up so much in your mind that you can have a feeling of shiver about it? And when he says, the owl that calls upon the night speaks the unbeliever's fright. Quite good. He who torments the chafer's sprite weaves a bower in endless night. Kill not the moth nor butterfly, for the last judgment draweth nigh. He shoot the beggar's dog and widow's cat, feed them, and thou shalt grow fat. The gnat that sings his summer song, poison gets from slander's tongue. The poison of the snake and newt is the sweat of envy's foot. The poison of the honeybee is the artist's jealousy. The prince's robes and beggar's rags are toadstools on the miser's bags. Now this one is really a good one. A truth that's told with bad intent beats all the lies you can invent. A truth that's told with bad intent beats all the lies you can invent. And then these were in the film, and I wondered if you knew, if you had any idea what it meant. It is right, it should be so. Man was made for joy and woe, and when this we rightly know, through the world we safely go. Did any of you get any idea of what that meant? It is right, it should be so. Man was made for joy and woe, and when this we rightly know, through the world we safely go. What do you think that would mean? I mean, you wouldn't have to be a Blakean to understand. I mean, what do you see it as, just what do you think the words mean?
Just happiness and sorrow have an equal part for the life, and it tries to deny one and the other isn't right, and to accept both of them, if you try to deny either the other one, you're going to have a really messed up life, because there's no way you can
Well, right, and the thing is, if you really can, if you understand that happiness isn't going to be your handmaid all through your days, if you can accept this, you can go through life with and it doesn't mean that you have to be a stoic, as you know Blake was anything but that, but that there is a combination. And if you're going to resent every time something goes wrong, you're going to cause yourself more bitterness than it's worth.
And often when you're at a maturing point, it's painful. But even though it's painful, it's still good for you.
Yeah.
So you should not just exactly chuckle about it, but
no, it isn't
for your benefit,
right? It isn't something that you don't have to feel. That what happens is, I've got to be sure to look for all the bad I can, because I should have my share. Because a lot of people feel like, oh, I've got it. I'm really having it. I'm really enjoying life too much. I mean, God must really, or whoever it is. I mean, if there isn't a God, then it's somebody else. And, that's kind of a feeling that the fates are against you or something, and you better not let them know. I don't know how many of you saw The Good Earth or read The Good Earth. Remember the part where he says, oh, he doesn't really mean it. We haven't had a good crop. We've had a terrible year.
Yeah.
Don't get us wrong. My son doesn't really know any better. We really have had a terrible time. Because a lot of people have a very deeply ingrained feeling that that God is against them. He really wants you to suffer. That's really the whole lesson in life. But this is really it's more the idea that there's going to be both and. Joy and woe are woven fine, a clothing for the soul divine. Under every grief and pine runs a joy with silken twine. And then this is good. Tools were made and born were hands. Every farmer understands. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many of you have been farmers. I know some of you know. Tools were made, born were hands. Every farmer understands. See, I was wondering if there was another one in here. But, he who mocks the infant's faith shall be mocked in age and death. He who shall teach the child to doubt, the rotting grave shall ne'er get out. He who respects the infant's faith triumphs over hell and death. The questioner who sits so sly shall never know how to reply. He who replies to words of doubt doth put the light of knowledge out. He who replies to words of doubt doth put the light of knowledge out. And then there's, if the sun and moon should doubt, they'd immediately go out. Now the important thing about understanding this whole dealing with doubt that Blake is talking about here is that that you just have to live in a faith and a risk, sort of an in spite of the rationale of things. You still have to take the steps and the leaps forward, and this is why he says this about the sun and moon, that there isn't much point to, you can't really think in terms of anything that doesn't require a certain amount of faith. David Swenson was a really tremendous teacher that I had at the University of Minnesota in philosophy, and who a lot of things that I never knew before. But he, particularly in the field of philosophy, but he said that it was impossible for anybody to be a skeptic more than for one moment. You cannot be a skeptic, a consistent skeptic, for one moment, because you have to. He said, what could you do? He said, you'd have to sit in the place you were in, and you wouldn't dare to take a step forward, because you have no guarantee, you have no belief, unless you believe that the floor is there, or have a sense of the floor being there, or the ground under you, or that there's some kind of, position for you to put your feet into. You are unable to go forward. And he said, he used to laugh at people who wanted to maintain certain kinds of philosophical positions, because he said they can't be consistent in them. They think they are, but he said they don't dare to really put logic to the test and actually examine their own positions. And this is what Blake is doing in kind of a very poetic way about the. About the sun and moon. We are led to believe a lie when we see with, not through, the eye. And he used to say this about the window, that you don't look with a window, you look through it. In other words, that the important thing for all of you, for all people, is to look out at the world, to see the world in all of its greatness, and then see beyond it into its whole, full, eternal meaning. And he said, if you stop with where you are and just use what you've, you know, just say, well, it's beautiful right here. My, that's a beautiful tree. And you don't see that that tree is part of God's creation. It's part of the huge, tremendous significance that all of creation has for human beings and for all creation that we know. He said, if you just see that in and of itself, you're just looking at that, but you're not seeing the whole vision that is lying before you. And this, as I said yesterday, requires energy, passion, real work to press forward into, so that you get a real sense of it. So you aren't just satisfied with looking at something and saying, isn't that beautiful? But that you allow it to really open up a whole new world to you. There's one, then I wanted to just refer to a couple of things that he said in the Everlasting Gospel, because as I say, the other one, the auguries of innocence are fairly simple, but the Everlasting Gospel is talks about Jesus in very, very in a rhyme, in a lot of rhyme couplets again, and very well, they're shocking. They're not the kind of thing that you would you think about when you think about what you're gonna, if you were gonna lay out a creed or a catechism or anything. But there again, it's a fun thing to see what he was doing with it and how he understood the his to do with it. And how he did the how he understood the meaning of the person of Jesus, and why he said some of the things that I talked to you about yesterday, how he understood the way in which he read the Bible as different from the way you and I read it, or the way a lot of other people read it, or who have taught us what we know about it. The introduction here, I just wanted to mention to you, is rather good, I think. The key to the meaning of the entire poem is perfectly simple. To comprehend it, we need only to remember that in Blake's view of the Christian doctrine, the second person of the Trinity was before all things the Logos, a word, which he translates human imagination. For without this, for us at least, was not anything made that was made. And he understood very clearly that Jesus was born in order to be a translation, or to be a form of God that we could grasp, because we could never grasp the eternal God. He's too great, too far, too tremendous for any of us. Now, I just want you to think about this, because I don't think any of us probably have ever read. I've read this before, but if you haven't, I'm sure you haven't read anything like it. Was Jesus gentle, or did he give any marks of gentility? When 12 years old, he ran away and left his parents in dismay. When after 3 days' sorrow found loudest Sinai trumpet sound, no earthly parents, I confess, my heavenly Father's business. Ye understand not what I say, and angry force me to obey. Obedience is a duty then, and favor gains with God and men. John from the wilderness loud cried, Satan gloried in his pride. Come, said Satan, come away, I'll soon see if you obey. John for disobedience bled, but you can turn the stones to bread. And then he goes, then another part, he goes on and says, Blake didn't think that Jesus did all the right things. He should never have gotten into trouble with the government. If he'd been used some sense, he wouldn't have had to be, smashed the way he was. You know, he should have worked it out a little bit differently. But then that was the way he did it, so I had to put up with it. But anyway, he says, when the rich learned Pharisee came to consult him secretly, upon his heart, now this is, listen to the poetry of it, some of the imagery that he has. Upon his heart, with iron pen he wrote, "You must be born again." He was too proud to take a bribe. He spoke with authority, not like a scribe. He says with most consummate art, "Follow me, I am meek and lowly of heart." As that is the only way to escape the miser's net and the glutton's trap. He who loves his enemies hates his friends. This surely was not what Jesus intends, but the sneaking pride of heroic schools and the scribes and Pharisees' virtuous rules. But he acts with honest triumphant pride, and this is the cause that Jesus died. He did not die with Christian ease, asking pardon of his enemies. If he had, Caiaphas would forgive. Sneaking submission can always live. He had only to say that God was the devil, and the devil was God, like a Christian civil. Mild Christian regrets to the devil confess for affronting him thrice in the wilderness. Like to Priestley and Bacon and Newton, poor spiritual knowledge is not worth a button. But thus the gospel St. Isaac confutes. God can only be known by his attributes. St. Isaac, of course, is Isaac Newton. He had soon been bloody Caesar's elf, and at last he would have been Caesar himself. And as for the indwelling of the Holy Ghost or Christ and his Father, it's all a boast or pride and fallacy of the imagination that disdains to follow this world's fashion. To teach doubt and experiment certainly was not what Christ meant. What was he doing all that time from 10 years old to manly prime? Was he then idle, or the less about his Father's business? Or was his wisdom held in scorn before his wrath began to burn in miracles throughout the land that quite unnerved the Seraphim? If he had been Antichrist, creeping Jesus, he'd have done anything to please us. Gone sneaking into synagogues and not used the elders and priests like dogs, but humble as a lamb or ass, obeyed himself to Caiaphas. God wants not man to humble himself. That is the trick of the ancient elf. This is the race that Jesus ran, humble to God, haughty to man, cursing the rulers before the people, even to the temple's highest steeple. And when he humbled himself to God, then descended the cruel rod. If thou humblest thyself, thou humblest me. Thou also dwellest in eternity. And then he says, got really interesting part here. Thou art a man, God is no more. See, this is where what Blake was very, very concerned about was that he felt that God, you had to understand that God was in you. If you believed that God was only out there, then you were never going to understand the reality of the God that had come to dwell in your own heart. Now I can't go along with his theology on that, but he does have this sense that people needed to understand that human beings are created by God. They're children of God, and that God has given them something of himself when he created them. Thy own humanity learn to adore, for that is my spirit of life. Awake, arise to spiritual strife, and I have revenge abroad display in terrors at the last judgment day. God's mercy and long-suffering are but the sinner to justice to bring. Thou on the cross for them shall pray, and take revenge at the last day. Jesus replied in thunders hurled, I never will pray for the world. Once I did so when I prayed in the garden, I wished to take with me a bodily pardon. Can that which was of women born in the absence of the morn, when the soul fell into sleep and archangels round it leap, shooting out against the light fibers of a deadly night, reasoning upon its own dark fiction and doubt, which is self-contradiction? Humility is only doubt, and does the sun and moon blot out, roofing over with thorns and stems the buried soul and all its gems? This life's five windows of the soul distort the heavens from pole to pole and lead you to believe a lie when you see with, not through, the eye, which was born in a night to perish in a night when the soul slept in beams of light. Now, you know, that just can go on. Now, what does it mean? You can go over it a number of times and find five or six different meanings. But he goes on, and the whole next section is a discussion of the woman taken in adultery, and the real problem that as I discussed yesterday of the fact that society does nothing for the situation that produces the need for this kind of thing, and therefore it's a lot of the fault lies with society, because he felt that marriage and the home and all of the kind of things that we're taking for granted as what we should have were not satisfying people, and therefore the prostitution and the kind of thing that we know now as pornography runs rife, because all people are worried about in punishment and in any kind of correction is to get rid of the person who is doing the thing. They really never care about changing the condition that is producing it or producing that person's crime. So that what we do is put the person in jail and say, or fine them or punish them in some way. But we never do anything to say, now why is it that this is going on so much? Why do we have so much of this? Just go along and say, you know, well, too bad about that, but let's get rid of the person. It's because we don't really care. And he felt that society was very much at fault here, and he wasn't too wrong. I'm going to read just the end of it, because this is last part is kind of typical. His 70 disciples sent against religion and government. They by the sword of justice fell, and him their cruel murderer tell. He left his father's trade to roam a wandering vagrant without home, and thus he others' labor stole that he might live above control. The publicans and harlots he selected for his company, and from the adulteress turned away God's righteous law that lost its prey. And the postscript is, I'm sure this Jesus will not do either for Englishman or Jew. Well, the thing is, we don't, as I say, necessarily agree with all the ways in which Blake expressed himself, nor what he said. But I don't think any of us has any idea of how utterly shocked we really would be if we allowed Jesus to actually walk out of the written page, because we're so completely covered with the protective traditions that we don't allow his real I was going to not coarseness but just bluntness to come and hit us. We somehow can kind of make it sound like the generation of vipers, and it sounds so sweet. And yet if anything like that were said anywhere, in any group, where we were present, we would be really upset to think that anybody that we related to was saying something like that. And Dorothy Sears is very concerned about exactly the same thing. She feels that the milksopping business that has been going along all of these centuries in terms of the person of Christ and the way in which we've emasculated him and taken all of the guts out of him is such a tragedy that you almost begin to feel that maybe some of Blake's idea about this female principle is true, that we've made him be mother's nice little boy, you know, he's Mary's little son, and instead of the Son of God, he becomes a kind of an idealized Boy Scout or something of that nature. The it's interesting that a woman, like that it was a woman who really nailed a lot of these things down, like Dorothy Sayers.